This is New Media Beat on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Alex Heike.
And I am Jacob Friedenberg.
Who makes the rules for the internet in Europe? What is the European Union's plan for internet regulation?
The European Union sets legal limits on what big tech can do in Europe. How do they do it? How does this digital legislation restrict social media in Germany? What is the Digital Services Act? Does it protect users from the dark side of the internet? Or are these new digital laws only censoring free expression?
We all love K-pop. The world loves K-pop. K-pop is one of South Korea's biggest exports economically and culturally.
What is it like to be a K-pop performer or a K-pop star? Are there shadows behind the bright lights of K-pop? Is the star-making machinery just grinding people up? Just how hard is it to become a K-pop star in the famous factories of South Korea?
Have you heard of virtual YouTube? Who are the VTubers of Japan? Why are they getting rich?
It's a big business out there. Just how influential are the VTube stars of Japan? Is this Japan's next big cultural export?
Would you like a free, all-expense-paid trip to the World Cup in Qatar?
Qatar will pay your way if you agree to their code of social media content. What does the code of conduct mean for the World Cup fans in Qatar? What's more important, free expression or a free trip? Which would you choose?
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a social media war.
There is an ongoing TikTok war. Why did TikTok ban a Palestinian terrorist group from the platform at the request of Israel? Who are the Lions of Palestine, and what were they doing on TikTok? Is TikTok becoming a tool for terrorists?
Has the government of Iran stopped the protest that exploded after the death of Mahsa Amini in the custody of the morality police?
How are digital protesters using online tools to fight the government of Iran? Can Iranians still use social media to fight the power? Or will the government shut down the internet and the digital activists?
Can the Russian government use the law to contain LGBTQ culture?
Why does Putin insist that LGBTQ content is dangerous propaganda? Does Russia really need stricter anti-gay content laws? Putin thinks so. Why now? When Russia is at war? What does Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine have to do with sexuality and moral culture in Russia?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York, College at Old Westbury.
Let's get started with internet news from Europe. The European Union, or the EU, makes the rules for the internet. They make rules for telecommunications, for digital services, and for the digital economy itself. When the rules change in the EU, the giants of the digital marketplace need to change their behavior. The EU wants big tech to follow its rules. The EU includes most of Europe. There are 27 member nation states. There were 28, but the United Kingdom, or known as the UK, Brexited from the EU on the last days of 2020. Who are the remaining 27 member states? Let me list them in size order, from biggest and richest members of being Germany to the small island nation of Malta in the Mediterranean. Here is the list of EU member states. They include Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Poland, Romania, Netherlands, Belgium, the Czech Republic, Greece, Portugal, Sweden, Hungary, Austria, Bulgaria, Denmark, Finland, Slovakia, Ireland, Croatia, Lithuania, Slovenia, Latvia, Estonia, Cyprus, Luxembourg, and Malta. I know it's a lot of members. All 27 members of the European Union, the 22 were just listed. Their representatives meet in Brussels to make the rules that regulate the internet and allow access to the prosperous digital marketplace of Europe. If you want to do business online in Europe, you got to follow the EU rules. Jessica Farrell is here to report on some new EU rules for internet and digital marketplaces in Europe. Jessica, what is the Digital Services Act? And how are these new regulations affecting internet users in Germany, the biggest nation in Western Europe?
The Digital Service Act was created by the European Union, and the goal of it was to help limit the amount of hate speech, disinformation, and illegal content posted online, and it affects social media users by stopping them from posting these things.
What laws have been created?
The Digital Service Act was created by the European Union, and then in 2018, Germany had its own law created called the Network Enforcement Act, which forces companies to censor on the government's behalf.
What does the Digital Services Act mean for social media platforms?
Social media platforms are required to take down any hate speech and illegal content posted. The DSA forces companies to police their platforms more strictly. If they don't, social media platforms could be fined for billions of dollars.
Are social media users in Germany having their content being taken down?
Yes, German artist Barbara posted her work on Instagram and Facebook. Her posts made jokes regarding the government. This caused her accounts to be threatened to be taken down permanently. There was a lot of backlash from her fans because nothing she posted was illegal or hate speech. Her post, because of the backlash from all of her fans, a Facebook spokesperson came out and said that all of her posts will be put back up and her accounts will not be taken down.
What is the importance of the DSA or the Digital Services Act?
So the DSA is important because a lot of people get all their news from social media platforms, and this from disinformation being posted or illegal content being posted could cause a negative impact.
Lastly, is the EU the only place creating these kinds of laws?
No, other countries outside of the EU are, like the United States and Canada, are creating similar laws. Although laws like DSA are different in other countries I have looked at in the past, like India and Pakistan, their laws punish social media users where the DSA punishes social media platforms, which brings up the argument, should the platforms be punished or should the users? For No Media Beat, I am Jessica Farrell. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Jessica. South Korean cultural exports are big business for the world. Things such as esports, movies, soap operas, and most of all, music, make a lot of people money. The world loves K-pop. But the industry is a competitive business, and sometimes the star-making machinery of K-pop can be rough on the talent. Just how tough is the business of K-pop for young artists? Here to tell us about the other side of K-pop is Ananda Hogard-Shannon. Ananda, are you a fan? Do you have a favorite group?
I do have a favorite group, but, you know, not to divide the fan base, I'm not going to disclose that.
Fair enough. So, we're talking about the dark side of K-pop today. Mm-hmm. Why is this not being talked about more?
It's not being talked about more simply because it's a hear no evil, see no evil situation. When you are a K-pop trainee, you're signed to a company, majority of the day you are spent practicing and training your vocal ability and your dancing capabilities. So when you are in those training sessions, they take your phone, and that takes up the majority of your day. Other than that, you have your phone to just strictly communicate with your managers and then sometimes your family, but they also monitor your communication, so you are not allowed to have social media because they monitor those as well. So it's not, they can't talk about it, simply.
It sounds like being a K-pop star is not all that it's made out to be. What does this pressure mean for the future of the K-pop industry?
It simply means that it's going to continue as is, unfortunately, because of what I just mentioned. Trainees are not allowed to discuss what happens when you are a trainee, nor are you allowed to disclose that, hey, I am in a group that has yet to debut. Once you debut, you're under strict regulation, so a very strict diet where you have like a small styrofoam cup and that's all you're allowed to eat. You can't change your hair color. You can't cut your hair unless the management company allows you to. You basically have no freedom whatsoever. And South Korean media as a whole recognizes this as a problem, but it's made them so much money so far, they may as well continue with the business model.
You've mentioned all of these restrictions that these K-pop stars are under. What are some of the other things, if there are any other things, that go on behind closed doors?
Well, for one, for females, obviously we have that time. They just expect you to behave and continue training as if nothing were to happen. And also, they expect you to train if you are sick. If you're completely sick, not feeling well, they expect you to keep up with your physical regimen. And also for females in particular, when you are living in a dorm, you are expected to take a picture of your weight and send that to your manager and send a picture to your company of your food. That way they can keep track of how much you weigh. So that way they can maintain the image that they want when they are trying to debut your group, which could take years.
And lastly, we know how big the K-pop industry is in America. I mean, you've mentioned yourself that you're a big K-pop fan. How large is the K-pop industry in South Korea?
It's absolutely massive. In South Korea, the majority of the culture that you see promoted is idol culture. So people walk outside and see many companies advertising, hey, we can make you a K-pop idol. Here are some of the people we've made, who we made it big with. So it's absolutely massive, and people will drop out of school to train with for the chance to be in a K-pop group and debut. But in terms of massive, I would say there are at least 40-something groups looking to, you know, that have debuted in this past year, looking to get bigger to the size of Blackpink or BTS. But who knows? There are just that many management groups and groups overall. For New Media Beat, I'm Ananda Hogarshannon. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Ananda. Japan is also a major exporter of media and online content. My co-host, Alex Heiko, is waiting to tell us about the VTubers of Japan. Alex, let's start with the basic question. What is virtual YouTube? What is a VTuber?
Well, YouTube in Japan is like any other YouTube like we have here, but about 3 years ago, they discovered this concept of a VTuber, which is where these YouTubers would do voiceovers and animate many different characters. And some of the top accounts in the industry can bring in more than $1 million a year.
When did these VTubers become a thing? How long has it been going on?
These VTubers, they started emerging around 5 years ago, and there's over 16,000 active streams globally. The fan bases are expanding into other platforms like TikTok and the gaming site Twitch.
How can you make a living from being a VTuber?
The main way they make their living is through this thing called Super Chat. Super Chat is basically people will donate and it'll have like their message pop up on the screen, and it gives the viewer like pleasure. They get to see them being acknowledged on the stream, and the point of the chat is it's extra money, and the top 9 VTubers each have earned between $700,000 and $1.7 million from the chat.
Lastly, what is the general audience for these VTubers?
It might be a surprise to people, but it's like older people. As there's a quote from this 30-year-old VTuber fan that says, "I really want her to notice me. I'm here visiting her channel." He says also that he dedicates maybe 5 to 10 hours of just thinking about her. And that's crazy to me because, I mean, you'd think that these people would be interested in, they'd go for a younger audience, but it seems from my research it's mostly older men. And I think that these Japanese VTubers have found themselves a goldmine with this and can lead to a lot of opportunities for them. For New Media Beat, I'm Alex Heiko. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Alex. Do you want to go to the World Cup? I mean, who wouldn't want to go on a free, all-expenses-paid trip to the World Cup in Qatar? The government of Qatar is ready to pay your way. But what's the catch? What does Qatar want in exchange for paying your way to the World Cup?
The World Cup is a massive global media event. Nations compete for the privilege and prestige of hosting it. This World Cup is in Qatar. The host government is offering a special deal for fans. Qatar will pay your way if you agree to follow their rules for posting on social media. Why is Qatar making this offer to thousands of fans? What do the fans think about following Qatar's rules for social media? Tanya Fizemay is reporting for New Media Beat. Tanya, tell us a little bit about Qatar first. Is it a big nation? Prosperous? What kind of government does Qatar have? How can it afford to host the World Cup and make this generous offer?
Qatar is one of the smallest wealthy countries due to oil wealth. They have about 650,000 people. Their government poses as a semi-constitutional monarchy. The issue people have with Qatar and the World Cup is that the World Cup was built up majorly by migrant workers, which Qatar has a past history of exploiting their workers. Locals and potential believes that Qatar is hosting the World Cup as a way to cover up their problems.
Why is Qatar giving out free tickets?
They're giving out free tickets in exchange for positive comments on social media about the Qatar's government and their hosted event, the World Cup.
What are the fans required to do once they accept the free tickets?
They are required to encourage and persuade others to support the World Cup. They are asked to create, like, and share positive posts about the World Cup. It is expected to report and screenshot any offensive comments found online to the World Cup organizers. It is also advised for them to gain more expertise and knowledge on the operational planning of the World Cup for the overall fans experience.
What are the consequences if the code of conduct is not followed?
Since the fan leaders' social media is under watch, they are subject to remove any posts that may seem offensive on their part. Also, all their perks can be taken away.
Why are some fans refusing to go?
Some fans and potential travelers are boycotting the Qatari government due to past issues of violating human rights, some being women needing permission from their husbands to work certain jobs or wanting to travel. Migrant workers are also not getting paid their full minimum wage, if any at all. Any offensive or negative comments online towards the Qatari government can result in imprisonment with a fine of 100,000 royal, which is close to 30,000 in U.S. currency. For New Media Beat, I'm Tanya Fieseman. Back to you, Alex.
Thanks, Tanya. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict seems endless. What part does social media play in the tensions? In the violence? Is there a social media conflict between Israelis and Palestinians? How should online platforms moderate extreme content in the Middle East? How do extremists and governments and the military use the internet to make war and keep the peace? My co-host, Jacob Friedenberg, is ready to talk about TikTok and a Palestinian terrorist group called the Lions. TikTok just banned the Lions from the platform at the request of the Israeli government. Jacob, how are the Lions using TikTok that led to them being deplatformed?
So this group known as the Lion's Den has been under fire, especially recently from the state of Israel. Israel just requested that they be banned from TikTok in light of them showing attacks on TikTok against the IDF, or also known as the Israel Defense Forces. The Lion's Den terror group, they have been going out and committing shootings against IDF soldiers, and they have been posting these videos on TikTok in order to show that their resistance against the supposed occupation of Palestine is making progress.
So who is the Lion's Den, like, more in depth?
Who is Lion's Den? To put it simply, they're a newfound terrorist group that were founded this past summer in the Nablus region of Israel, which is found in the West Bank. Their primary focus, again, is to stop the Israel occupation of Palestine. Now, I'm not commenting on whether it's actually meant to be Israel or Palestine, but this has been a long-standing issue between Palestinians and Israel of who actually has rights to that land. And they were founded by this man named Ibrahim al-Nablusi. Now, that may not seem like a very significant name to many people, but the reason why this name is significant and pops up quite a bit is because he is the son of a colonel of the Palestinian army who was supposed to be coordinating with the Israeli defense forces, who are supposed to then go out and stop any sort of terrorist groups that unfortunately his son ended up becoming a part of.
So what was the main reason the Lion's Den was banned from TikTok?
Well, for starters, they were, according to the Times of Israel, banned at the request of the state of Israel, citing that they were threats to the state and that multiple attacks, including a drive-by shooting against Ido Baruch, who was an IDF soldier, as a reason to stop the group from having presence on social media. The group has posted videos of their members, again, shooting at IDF soldiers, which they would entitle in the videos the Occupation Army. They have been using social media as a way to encourage other individuals and groups in the region, such as Hamas, to push back against the supposed occupation of Israel. There has been a rise in anti-Israel and anti-Semitic content over the last number of years. In America, we have our own anti-Semitic, you know, controversies that are going on right now, especially with Kyrie Irving, the Nets basketball player who was suspended for his anti-Semitic posts on social media. But over the last number of years, you've seen a rise in anti-Semitic content, especially ones that are pro-Palestinian. In May of 2021, there was a man who was arrested for posting a video of himself burning the TikTok flag. I'm sorry, the Israeli flag, rather, on TikTok. The video was posted in May, where you see the man, you don't see his face, but you see him holding the flag of the Israel government, which is, you know, white flag with a blue Star of David, and he lights it on fire as soon as the video starts. You also have a video that came out of 98-year-old Lily Ebert, who was a Holocaust survivor, being harassed on TikTok by pro-Palestinian users. And then according to the Jerusalem Post, TikTok has become the epicenter of the media war between Palestine and Israel. That's a direct quote from the Jerusalem Post.
Has their social media presence been effective in achieving their goals?
It's really hard to judge whether it's been successful or not, but considering the Palestinian TikTok sphere continues to grow and expand and gain more eyes, some would say that it's at least fairly successful in at least achieving awareness. I mean, back in 2020, an animated video of an individual literally murdering Jews with hero music playing in the background was removed from TikTok, but we didn't really hear back in 2020 about this video being removed, but maybe that was because of other things going on in the world at the time. Who knows?
What does the future look like for the region with the emergence of the lines then?
Well, for starters, Israel could be at risk of a large-scale war. The lives of thousands of Israelis and Palestinians could be at risk. Again, I mentioned the situation with Kyrie Irving and Kanye West as a main indicator of where we are at in terms of anti-Semitism being on the rise. It's even grown to show some sort of acceptance. The fact that it took months and weeks for this group to be removed from TikTok shows that, unfortunately, anti-Semitism is slowly starting to be more and more accepted. And it's been undercovered for the last number of years, and it's deserving of more attention. But the attacks against the lone Jewish state for the world are problematic. And while the two-state solution is ideal, Israel, again, has not been the one primarily driving the conflict. That doesn't mean they're innocent. Israel has had some anti-Palestinian attacks that have not been great for their reputation. However, they have primarily been the ones who are trying to find a peaceful resolution to the Palestinian conflict. And the real issue is that we worry that there are going to be copycat social media groups like the Lion's Den, as according to Pew Research, 18 to 29-year-olds make up the highest percentage of those active on social media. And that's a problem because Lion's Den is primarily made of 18 to 29-year-old men. And if they're going to find members who are in similar age ranges as them, and since the 18 to 29-year-old group is the largest group that uses social media, we can see why that presents problems. For New Media Beat, I am Jacob Friedenberg. Back to you, Alex.
Thank you, Jacob. Iranians continue to protest the harsh policies of their government following the tragic death of Mahsa Amini in September. How are digital activists using social media and the internet to oppose their conservative government?
Has the government of Iran succeeded in repressing the protests in the streets? What about the online protests? What about all the videos that went viral? Are protest videos still being posted by activists? Can the hardline Islamic regime tame the internet and stop the memes? Ani Ashvili is here in Studio A to tell us about digital activism in Iran. Ani, how are protesters using their mobile phones and the internet to get around the censorship and the shutdowns in Iran? Can online activists in Iran share news and information with the world outside of itself? Can we see what is happening in Iran today?
Thousands have joined anti-government demonstrations throughout the country. Many Iranians have been killed, injured, and detained during the protests, which erupted following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, a woman who was killed for improperly wearing her hijab. Throughout these protests, many have been killed, and the state media has been lying about the number of deaths. Non-governmental organizations have been monitoring the situation and have reported higher number of deaths, including women and children, and hundreds injured across at least 11 provinces. This being said, it's unsafe to protest, and social media has been used as a tool for digital activism.
So you mentioned digital activism being a primary form of dissent on social media. What does digital activism in Iran look like?
Digital activism has been a very important form of activism right now in Iran. It's enabled women inside of Iran to depict, through simply a click of a button, how poorly they've been treated to a global audience. This is something that's been crucial for women in Iran because it shifts the scale of visibility for women's rights activism from a local stage to a global stage. Iranian women's digital activism has created an important space for the narration of their struggle to reach a wider audience. Women's bodies in Iran continue to be a site of contention by different political voices, and social media has become an important tool for women's rights activists to highlight some of these issues facing Iranian women.
So you mentioned the highlighting of certain rights or lack thereof on social media due to digital activism. Has there been any other outcomes that digital activism has brought to Iran?
There has been many different outcomes. The use of hashtags has been a strategic way to share collection of texts, images, and videos across social media platforms in an easily found and understood way. Hashtags like White Wednesday, My Camera Is My Weapon, Stealthy Freedom, Me Too Iran have been amplifying the voices and images of women who are challenging the discriminatory laws against women's bodies and sharing the poor treatment they've been subjected to. The hashtag Me Too Iran sparked an important conversation on sexual violence in the conservative country. After one female university student in Iran broke her silence on Twitter, many women have came forward online to reveal that they've been sexually abused by powerful men. A chain of narratives on sexual assault and rape started emerging out of that after years of silence. An important outcome of this has been that the police temporarily suspended the law of citing extramarital sexual relations as a crime so that women can be encouraged to come forward and testify against their abusers. This is the first time that a social media campaign was able to change policy in a conservative religious country. Even if it was short-lived, it created a societal shift in speaking out about sexual harassment more openly and marking a turning point in Iranian society.
What are the most commonly used social media apps in Iran?
The most commonly used social media apps in Iran right now are Telegram, Instagram, Pinterest, Facebook, and Twitter, which many Iranian government officials use. Even though many of these platforms were blocked, over 60 million active internet users use VPN. And in Iran, many people use VPN to access these apps.
And lastly, how did Iranian people respond to the government's attempts to block social media access?
Well, as I stated, they continue to use VPN to access these apps, but the attempts to block social media has created loud outrage. Iranian leaders did try to build their own domestic internet with copycat versions of Google and Instagram to help put their goal of shutting out the rest of the world and isolating Iranians from what's going on around them. But only a few million people in the country have downloaded them, and they're not as commonly used, mostly because of concerns about government surveillance. So many people have just been downloading VPNs and continuing to use it, even though the use of social media is a crime. At this point, people are fed up and are doing what they can. I am Ani Yashvili for New Media Beat. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Ani. We have media news from Russia. Putin's Russia is a harsh place during the war times. We've heard about censorship from anti-government sources. But wartime is especially hard for gay people. Why is gay culture such a threat to Putin and his many supporters? Why would Putin's government be making the laws about LGBTQIA plus content even stricter in the middle of the war? Is there a connection between the Russian brutality in Ukraine and the repression of homosexuality in Russia? Luca Giannalise has been looking into the politics of gay media and the law in Russia. Luca, tell us about the anti-gay content laws in Russia. When was this first law enforced? What does the law prohibit? And why is this law in the news right now?
Well, to start off with, these anti-gay laws have been around for quite a while now, since starting in like 2013, and then some were even put into power in 2018. But these have been in power for a while, but not really enforced to the full capacity like it has been in the last 2 years, and especially with the war going on between Ukraine and Russia. So now it's really been emphasized and really been put into power. It was around, and still people were oppressed, were being arrested, but not until the Russian-Ukrainian war, really.
So we know that the realities and conditions of non-cisgendered people and those that aren't heterosexual, they face different realities than we do. What are some of those realities and conditions that the LGBTQIA community are facing in Russia?
Well, it's really different for Russia because compared to other countries, Russia was actually named, you know, in the top five list of one of the most homophobic countries in the world. So it's really hard to be living there. But some of the realities and conditions are that these people, every day they face living in fear. You know, if there's any protests or any demonstrations, it's shut down right away, very quickly. The Russian government doesn't want that getting out of hand. The Russian police does not back these people up whatsoever. People, you know, can't go out in the street without the fear of being beat up or harassed, or just they can't really live freely as a other Russian citizen would. So they're just, they've been really oppressed over the years.
So much for Russian police defending the little guy. Why are Russian lawmakers passing this law, and what exactly is their end goal with it?
Well, so the Russian government stated that the purpose for these laws were to protect children from being exposed to homosexuality, condemn presenting homosexuality as being a norm in society, and under the argument that it contradicts traditional family values. As we know, Russia is a very traditional and conservative country. So their whole argument is that they're trying to protect their beliefs. The statute amended the country's child protection law and the code of the Russian Federation on administrative offenses to prohibit the distribution of propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations under minors. So really, there's other issues here, but they're really emphasizing on minors, and they don't want minors to be exposed. So in the idea, that's their goal, but really under the behind the curtains, they have different goals.
Is this in any way related to the current war in Ukraine? And if so, how?
It definitely is, because this is Russia's way of what they're doing in Ukraine. It's their justification to justify, like, hey, like, you know, there's a group of people in Ukraine that are a threat to our traditional and conservative beliefs. So we're going in there to kind of take care of that situation. So that's their justification. And that's why now these laws have been put into power over the years. That's why now the Russian government is cracking down within their own borders to suppress and oppress these people. So this is their justification to go into Ukraine and say, like, this is one of the reasons why we're doing what we are doing.
What other laws have been passed in these previous number of years?
So just in 2013, a bill was approved by the State Duma on 11 of June 2013, and the federal law was for the purpose of protecting children from information advocating a denial of traditional family values. And then there was another law passed in 2018 that was really steered towards propaganda of in any media form. So these laws have been into power over the previous years, and they're not something that's new. They're really been used now lately, ever since the war has started, because Putin has a fear that he wants to control his people, so he's doing anything in his power and any form to control them. And this is one way of controlling them and cracking down on their people. My name is Luca Gianalize. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Luca.
Thanks for listening to New Media Beat. Thanks to our producer, Michael Green, and our wonderful engineer, Tanya Fizeme. Many thanks to my co-host, Jacob Friedenberg.
Thanks, Alex. Today we heard reports from Jessica Farrow, Tanya Fizeme, our engineer, Jacob Friedenberg, myself, Alex Heiko, my co-host, Ananda Hogard-Shannon, Ani Ashvili, and Luca Gianalize.
New Media Beat is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, and the Media and Communications Department here at State University of New York, College at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts at newmediabeat.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's OWWRGMN.
Stay tuned for more great programming coming up next on the OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio.